Braniff International Airways flight is going from a stopover in Kansas City to Omaha, Nebraska, when they fall from the sky. What caused this flight to crash amongst thunderstorms?
Welcome back to the Hard Landings Podcast, everybody. I'm Miranda.
Oh, I'm Brendan.
And I'm Paige.
Yeah. So you're going to be like, first of all, Brendan's back.
Hello.
It's been like 3 years since you've been on the podcast.
It's been a while.
And Paige is here. And you're like, where's Christy and Nick? Well, there was a family thing that happened a few days ago and they need to spend some time with family. So they asked me and Brendan to fill in for them while they do stuff for family. That being said, you are now warned, because guess what? You have the two people talking the most that have learning disabilities. So yeah.
I learn fine. I don't talk good.
I can't spell and I can't read, so.
Oh, no, I can't read either.
And I have raging ADHD, so I interrupt everyone all the time. It's going to be fun, folks.
That'll be helpful for me.
You know, just hang in there, guys. Be nice. All right. This was like a last minute deal type of situation going on. So, okay. I think there's at least one new person to thank from Patreon.
See,
I'm not going to say this right. Thanks to Chien.
That's how I was going to say it.
Yeah. Chien. I think that's it. I don't think there's anybody else, but let me check. Nope. That should be it. So thank you, Chien, for, if that's how you say your name. I think I know who you are in real life. I don't know. You put a pronunciation somewhere, so it helps. Thanks. Do all the normal stuff. Newsletter should have gone out already. We're recording this the day before April 1st, so let's see if I actually remember to do that or not. So if you'd like to answer trivia questions, please do that. If you don't have access to it yet, because you didn't, you know, sign up in time, it's on the website. So go ahead and check it out. I don't think there's anything else I can think of in regards to housekeeping stuff. So we're just going to get started. So what are we covering today, Brendan?
This is Braniff Airways, Inc. Incorporated, also known as Braniff International Airways, I think they have it later on. Flight 250.
Thanks to Rich and Aliska for recommending this episode.
This was a BAC 111, which is an old airplane.
Very old.
Registration November 1553. Flight 250 was a regularly scheduled passenger/cargo flight operating from New Orleans, Louisiana to Minneapolis, Minnesota, with intermediate stops in Shreveport, Louisiana, Fort Smith, Arkansas, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Kansas City, Missouri, and Omaha, Nebraska.
Nebraska!
Nebraska.
So, the captain is Donald Pauly. He was age 47, was originally employed by Mid-Continent Airlines, Incorporated, and became a Braniff Airways Incorporated employee in August of 1952, when the two airlines merged together. He was promoted to reserve captain in 1945 and captain on April 8th, 1946.
Right after the war.
Good old war times. Captain Pauly completed the BAC 111 ground school on April 24th, 1965, and received his BAC 111 type rating June 1st, 1965. On January 7th, 1966, Captain Pauly's first proficiency check of the BAC 111 was graded unsatisfactory.
Uh-oh.
However, following 2.5 hours of additional instruction, the captain passed a recheck.
That's good. Solid.
He also had a grand total of 2,767 hours, including 549 hours in the BAC 111 at the time of the accident.
Ex-cilantro.
It's pretty.
When did the accident occur?
Yeah, I was going to ask that. I don't think you ever said the date.
Well, happened on August 6th, 1966.
Okay, that helps a lot. So when. Okay, so that. Helps a lot.
Yeah.
His check that he failed sounds like it was not long before that. It was in the months.
Like a year.
A year. Well, it was 1965.
No, I thought that's when you said he got his type rating, but then he had a check on it afterwards in 1966.
Okay. Please hold.
He passed January of 1966.
Okay, so 7 months ahead of time of the crash, he failed a thing. Or not failed, but
right.
What was it? Not
so he had already flown those, or like a proficiency check later on.
Okay.
I'm assuming that's what that what is. All right, that's the captain. The first officer, James Hilliker, I'm going to go with that, was age 39, was also hired to Mid-Continent Airlines in July 29th, 1943, as a baggage handler.
Wow.
He obtained his commercial pilot's license in October of 1955 and completed training as a flight engineer in March of 1956.
Okay.
Okay.
First officer had 9,296 hours of total pilot time with 685 hours in the BAC 111.
So why was he the first officer and the captain was the captain?
The captain right. had more hours.
I thought you said the captain had 2,000.
20,000.
Oh.
Oh, God.
I heard 2,000 like you did.
Okay, so if you heard that before like I did, and maybe it's just my brain that that up, so be aware. But if you heard 2,000, it was 20,000. We're not going to go back and edit that. That's already a mess as it is. But there you go. That makes more sense. So the captain had 20,000 and the first officer had about 9,000.
So the first officer had more time in that type aircraft.
Okay. That's, I mean, that's not the first time we've heard of that either. So.
Okay. Story time.
So you see what happened was.
What had happened was.
They, spoiler, they died.
I mean, they're on this podcast. There's like a 65 to 75% chance that, yes, they died.
Yeah. That's the unfortunateness of, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the flight went as scheduled, as normal. But the Braniff station personnel at New Orleans, where the flight originated from, also in Kansas City, originally stated that they had shown concern regarding the weather between Kansas City and Omaha.
Womp womp.
That was the leg where the accident happened, was between Kansas City and Omaha. There was no record of any contact between the captain and the dispatcher other than the routine transmission of flight releases. I'm just kind of setting up some context here. Braniff had both landline and radio facilities available to the dispatcher and the flight crew, which could have been used, had either desire to contact the other regarding en route weather. While in Kansas City, Captain Pauly discussed the weather with the captain of another Braniff flight, which had just arrived from Chicago. The captain of this latter flight stated, "I told him this was a solid line of very intense thunderstorms with continuous lightning and no apparent breaks."
Which is big no-no. We don't fly through those.
No.
"As a long and mean one, as I had seen in a long time, I didn't feel the radar reports have given a true picture of the intensity." Captain Pauly replied that he hoped to be west of that particular line.
Yeah.
So that was before the flight when he was in Kansas City. Then Flight 250 departed from Kansas City at 22:55 local time. On an instrument flight, that's pretty late at night.
Yeah, 9, almost 10 o'clock
that
night.
That is almost 10:55.
No, almost 11 o'clock. Almost 11 o'clock. I can't. Later. Military, yeah.
It's not, yeah.
They departed on an instrument flight rules clearance, that's IFR for you airplane nerds, to Omaha via jet route 41 at a flight level 200 or 20,000 feet. Just prior to takeoff, the flight was restricted to 5,000 feet until further advised due to air traffic control, conflicting advisory stuff. Air traffic controllers know what I'm talking about.
Traffic in the area?
Yeah, conflicting traffic.
Yeah.
Okay.
When the flight was about 12 miles north of Kansas City, air traffic control was transferred to the Kansas City Air Route Traffic Control Center.
Okay.
Radar contact was confirmed and the flight was cleared to climb to and maintain flight level 200. After some discussion with the center about the weather, the flight crew advised that they would like to maintain 5,000 feet all the way to Omaha. So just cruising out at 5,000 feet there.
It seems pretty low.
I was going to ask because I don't really know.
I mean, they used to do low and slow, right? So, I mean, it's not that unheard of that they were like down to 20,000, right?
But well, I mean, jet age, 20,000 is like, it's a really short distance between Kansas City and Omaha.
I don't
know the mileage, but 5,000 feet is like what I would do in like my little Cessna.
That's what I was going to ask. That feels a little low for a big commercial airplane? Flight.
Big jet, yeah.
Bigger airplane? Because this is like, I don't know. I pulled up a picture of it. It's a T-tail, by the way.
It is.
That means nothing
That's
to me.
Actually it's important explained. For later for my part, but here, I'll show you.
What is a T-tail? Oh, that is really cool.
Yeah. So it's a T at the tail. Instead of it being on the bottom, it's at the top.
Okay.
That's where the elevators are.
That's really cool.
The horizontal stabilizer.
Yeah, there we go. Horizontal stabilizer.
They reported that they were at 6,000 feet and center cleared the flight to maintain that altitude until 5,000 was available.
Traffic.
At 2303, the Kansas City Air Route Traffic Control Center initiated the transfer of control of the flight to Chicago Air Route Traffic Control Center.
So are they going northeast? Northwest?
Basically just north.
Northwest?
Basically north.
Just straight north?
Almost. Maybe a little bit to the west.
Okay.
So they end up where ultimately? Oklahoma? Well,
Nebraska.
Nebraska. Omaha.
But they are like, if you ever look at the map over this crash happened, they are barely in Nebraska.
Okay.
They're like a few miles, like that's probably a mile away from the border of Nebraska.
Okay.
To the other state, whatever, near Iowa.
There we go.
Anyway, they were going over to Chicago, but before the transfer could be accomplished, the flight requested and received permission from the Kansas City controller to deviate left of course. Then at 2306, Kansas City controller cleared the flight to descend and maintain 5,000 and contact the Chicago Center. After some discussion of the weather, as it had displayed on the controller's radar, the flight was advised that another brand of flight, Flight 255, was on the same frequency and was at 10,000 feet, climbing to 17,000 feet after departing Omaha. The crews of the two aircraft exchanged weather information, and the crew of Flight 255 advised that they had encountered light to moderate chop,
basically turbulence.
Yeah.
From about 15 miles southeast of Omaha Airport, and that it appeared that they would be out of it in another 10 miles based on their radar observations.
Okay.
Flight 250 terminated this conversation at approximately 2308 and 30 seconds. This was the last transmission received from the flight.
So are they going, is 255 going the opposite direction?
255 took off. They were headed to...
You said they took off out of Omaha.
They were going from Omaha to someplace else.
Okay, but they were going the opposite direction of where that plane was going?
Like southeast.
Okay, all right, okay.
I think. That's what I think I just got from that.
Okay.
So essentially we came out of the storm you're going into.
Right.
Okay.
Basically.
That's the idea anyway.
Ground witnesses stated that they saw an explosion in the sky followed by a fireball falling out of the clouds. The aircraft crashed approximately at 2312. When 6.7 statute miles on a true bearing of 024.5 degrees from Falls City, Nebraska, at an elevation of 1,078 feet.
I'm guessing everyone perished in the accident.
I do believe so.
That would be my guess since it blew up.
Well, we'll get there. Another paragraph here. Witnesses in the area of the accident reported that they observed the aircraft approach and either fly into or over a shelf of clouds preceding a line of thunderstorms that was approaching from the north and northeast.
That's what I was wondering. I'm gonna predict lightning strike.
Okay.
Well, we'll get into it.
Okay.
The clouds in the area of the accident were described as rolling or boiling in a circular motion, forward from top to bottom.
Oh, that's not good.
The cloud height was estimated to be from 1 to 2,000 feet above the ground. Shortly after the accident, witnesses reported that there was a definite wind shift from south to north.
Okay.
And that the wind velocity had increased. Estimates of the velocity varied from 30 to 60 miles per hour in different locations of the area. Rain was also reported in the accident area, beginning shortly after the accident, and was described, according to location, as light to moderate. All witnesses were sure the aircraft did not penetrate the main line of thunderstorms, which was northeast of the area in which the accident occurred.
Awesome.
There were 4 crew and 38 passengers on board. All were perished. The aircraft was destroyed.
Yes. Well, you got... If you think there's other stuff that we need to go over after I'm done with this, then we can do that.
Solid.
Sweet.
If I don't cover something that you think you read, just let me know. Okay. Again, guys, please be patient because this is different for us. So this crash was investigated by the CAB, or the predecessor to our today's NTSB. This was a CAB report. That's why it was shorter than it would have been if it was an NTSB report. Mm-hmm. There was a CVR on this flight, and they were able to read it off. I did not see anything about an FDR in the analysis, though, so I don't have any clue if an FDR was on the flight. And if there was, if there wasn't one, it wouldn't have been required at this point. Okay, so after looking into the history of the aircraft, investigators found that the aircraft was properly certified and was airworthy at the time of takeoff out of Kansas City. So there's nothing wrong with the airplane before it took off, as far as they're aware, based on mechanical records and the checks and stuff the pilots did before they left. They also found that the crew was properly certified and physically qualified for the flight. They weren't tired, they had enough rest time, all that stuff. I mean, as much as they would give them in the 60s. So it was quite obvious to the investigators early in the investigation that this was a structural failure of some kind, based on what they looked at the wreckage and things like that, and that the loads put onto the aircraft structure were the problem. There were some loads that were put onto the structure that just made it break apart. But investigators could not find the origin of those loads. So when they found the wreckage, there were things separated from the original airplane, the airplane area, that was separate from other things. That's how they knew it was a structural failure. I'll get into the specifics of that in a little bit, but due to this, the investigators focused on two premises: that the in-flight structural failure was a result of either an overload condition or an inadequate aircraft strength. So either the aircraft wasn't strong enough to withstand those loads, or there was way too much on that it failed because it went past its minimums or maximums or whatever. So they concluded the possibilities for an overload condition were, one, an encounter with some extreme weather condition. Okay, probably a good idea, right? Probably, yeah. Two, a combination of forces or accelerations produced by weather and pilot response. So over controlling the aircraft based on what was happening to the aircraft. And three, some system induced maneuver, trying to get out of something or whatever and overstressing the airplane. Other factors which also could have rendered the aircraft's under strength, so if it wasn't strong enough, could include if there were any fatigue or other prior damage before they took off, defective material used in the construction of the aircraft, deficiencies in design or structural strength of the aircraft, or inadequate design requirements based on, and I'll get into a little bit of that, not too much, because they don't know 100% what happened, but it has to do with like gusts of wind and areas and stuff. But I'll get into that in a second.
Math.
It's a lot of math. And I kind of skipped the math because I was like, listen, it failed. So to see if the strength was adequate, investigators conducted an extensive investigation of the development of the BAC-111, which included the design, certification, and construction of the aircraft. The NASA review of the aerodynamic load and stability predictions indicated that the methods used were satisfactory. They were fine. And were in fact quite similar to those in general used throughout the industry. So on other airplanes, like we talked about DC-3s, whatever the Boeing equivalent would have been at the time, I don't know. The 707 maybe? I don't know. I don't know enough about aviation.
I think the DC-9 was around then. The 707 should be around then. 747 was in development.
Yeah.
Probably was. I think it was actually released at this point. So that means I think 37 should have been released too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's about the right timeline.
Yeah, 66. Yeah. No, they definitely was.
And this is when Boeing was like, good, so.
Amazing.
Taking it back to a few weeks ago. Anyway, they also found similar findings stemmed from the review of the stress and dynamic analysis. So when they did a stress test on how well the airplane performed, it performed pretty well. And so they were like, okay, well, that's probably not the case. So there was no evidence found that which indicated that the strength of this aircraft was less than that predicted by calculations or less than specified in the applicable requirements. So based on what it was certified for, that's how strong it was.
So according to the report, they had to certify the aircraft to the requirements plus 50% of whatever it was to be fully certified, which it passed.
And it did. So there was no issues with the strength of the aircraft, as far as they're aware, based on what it was certified for. From examination of the wreckage, they uncovered no evidence that fatigue or other prior damage existed before the accident. I feel like that would be really hard to find in an aircraft that, like, exploded and fell to the ground. But as far as they're aware, there was no fatigue.
Okay. Pretty easy to tell metal fatigue.
Yeah, that's true, because it's a straight edge instead of a rough edge.
Ding.
Or the materials used to construct the aircraft, they were not, I mean, they were as specified, they were strong enough. So those
aluminum,
all those things were as they should have been when they checked this out. From eyewitness testimony, it was provided that the aircraft seemed to be fine until the disaster occurred.
In which it was on fire.
And fire! Then it was on fire. As a result of this review, the board considered the design of the BAC-111 was in accordance with the current state of the art, and that the aircraft met or exceeded all applicable design requirements. So they're like, yeah, it's fine. The aircraft itself did exactly what it was supposed to. Now, there was a section after this in the report about the velocities of how fast they should go through turbulence based on where the turbulence is. Went over my head. I read it 3 or 4 times and I was like, you know what?
It's like plus and minus this number of G's, yeah. Plus and minus that number of G's.
It was like this airspeed, this speed. This yeah, I was like, listen, I'm not an engineer. I'm okay with math, but that's too much math for me. So
the recommendation was 270 knots below 20,000 feet.
There you go.
Okay.
I did read that, but I was like, that's a lot. So, and there's no way to actually know how fast they were going, because there was no FDR. And if there was, there was nothing read off of it. So it would be hard for investigators to even know if the vertical or longitudinal or lateral gusts, if those were really the things that were causing the problem that caused this whole structure to fail. They assumed that's probably it because those are the forces that would be put on the aircraft from turbulence. But they were like, we should test it just in case so this doesn't happen to other airplanes. But
we can go through because the pilot did say.
I was just going to ask if there was anything on the CVR for the pilots, like any signs of distress or, you know, struggling.
I can go through that real quick.
If you want
please
to, go ahead.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So a review of the transcription of the tape showed that 8 minutes after takeoff, the crew requested the flight level change from 20,000 feet to 5,000. At 23:04 and 44 seconds, just after a short conversation referring to a hole in the line of clouds, Flight 250 requested permission to deviate left of course. At 23:06 and 56 seconds, in response to a query from Flight 250, Chicago Air Traffic Control Center controller replied that the line appeared to be, quote, pretty solid all the way from Pawnee to Des Moines.
Yeah, I actually cover that too later on, but
cool.
We'll
get to the next little part here.
Yeah. Go for it.
From 23:03 and 18 seconds until 23:10 and 59 seconds, there was intermittent cockpit conversation regarding deviation to Pawnee. At 23:11 and 33 seconds, the last intelligible crew voice transmission evident on the tape was ease power back.
Okay.
Okay. So I don't know if that answered your question or not, but
I don't know if it did, but like, at least it's not like, you know, super sounds of struggle.
No.
You know.
And to be honest, I mean, I think once they hit the whatever turbulence they hit, it was pretty fast from there.
Yeah, so. I guess that's what I was trying to get to was in my brain was like, okay, did more or less like, did they have to struggle with this problem or was it just like, oops, over?
Well, and you figure that out pretty fast when I tell you the thing that failed first.
Okay.
So that's not foreshadowing, but
the ease power back was about 30 seconds before the end of the tape.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. That was actually good because I didn't see that anywhere in the analysis. So cool. The board had no reason to believe that the initial part of the flight was conducted in a manner any different from any other flights in similar conditions. They took off. They flew. Ta-da. Like, it wasn't like they did anything wrong. However. The intensity of the weather system that crossed the intended route for Flight 250 appeared to have been underrated by airline personnel responsible for forecasting the weather and dispatching the aircraft. The captain also stated before the flight that he showed concern about the weather even before his departure from New Orleans. Turns out, he did not receive a formal weather briefing before leaving Kansas City, although facilities were available for this. So he never got, when he was in Kansas City, after they did the whole route from New Orleans to Shreveport to Kansas City, right? They never told him any updated weather. This is before ATIS, so it's not like he can call into a frequency and hear what the current weather is. They have to, dispatch basically has to tell him what the weather is, and he never got updated weather from Kansas City.
Not good.
A self-help weather briefing display was also available to the crew at Kansas City, which they didn't use. So, while talking to another captain, I mean, Brendan stated this before, it was said that, quote, this was a solid line with very intense thunderstorms with continuous lightning and no apparent breaks. As long and mean One is I'd seen in a long time, and I didn't feel the radar reports gave a true picture of the intensity, end quote. So, I mean, Brendan covered that in the first part, but he talked to a captain about how bad the weather is, and the captain was another captain. And the other captain was like, pretty bad. It was pretty bad.
They also had a very crude onboard weather radar.
Yes, they did. Which is what we talk about with the hole, which I'll get into in a second.
Okay. Perfect.
But this was never relayed to the Braniff dispatcher, the person who dispatches the plane. No one told him that. They were like, yeah, this is really bad. Although they should be looking that up themselves, the dispatcher. But
well, I mean, it's just that was it the complacency. They assume everyone just has the knowledge.
Yeah. And let me get into a little bit about the dispatcher ish things. So Braniff procedure prohibits the dispatch of an aircraft into such weather conditions. So they should not have even taken off. Based on the weather report that was given to the dispatcher for the flight, he decided it did not warrant grounding the airplane. The one he received, he was like, seemed fine to me. And it was like scattered thunderstorms.
Right.
Not a line of thunderstorms.
That's why they were like, oh, it's not that bad. We can get this flight going.
Yeah, so the actual report that the dispatcher got, based on what he had, he was like, yeah, they're good. But if he had heard the report from that pilot that had come in from through those thunderstorms, he probably would have been like, eh, maybe not. The board then determined that Flight 250 was dispatched in good faith, although that faith was founded on an inaccurate analysis of the weather situation.
Bingo.
Even though the pilot was nervous about the weather, there was never any talk about deviating. Now, that was wrong because we just talked about that. They talked a little bit about deviating, but that was...
It was probably pre-flight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The captain observed a hole in the squall line that he decided on the onboard radar that they had. And so he decided to just go through there instead. So we've actually talked about this hole before. It's actually a problem with really intense thunderstorms. I forget. I think it was a Garuda Indonesia flight we talked about. One of the early ones. Where they were in bad weather. And it looked like there was a hole in the severe thunderstorm area. And so they wanted to go through there. It turns out it's worse in that hole.
Okay.
And I can't remember the full science about it. I'd have to look it up again. But there was no hole.
Okay.
It was thunderstorm. The whole thing was thunderstorm. So, but the onboard radar looked like there was a hole. So that's why they were like, no, we're not going to deviate from here. There's a hole. We'll just go through the hole. Which, if that's what you're used to doing, and it's not an issue,
usually works.
Then that's what you do. The dispatcher was aware that other Braniff flights diverted to an alternate airport or remained on the ground until safe flight could be undertaken. This should have been passed on to Flight 250. The dispatcher would have performed his duties more properly had he recommended to the captain that the flight be delayed or rerouted to pass around the squall line. So we talked about how this was a structural failure. Okay.
Yes.
So how did this fail exactly? Well, let me tell you. It was found that the tail section of the aircraft failed first.
Okay.
Which is why the CVR stopped recording.
Yep.
Though they found that this could be questionable because they're like, well, how do you know for sure? But then they found like the wings came off. And so that's how they figured out that that's how it probably went. Is the tail went first.
Then the wings.
And then the wings went.
I thought I read on there that this didn't stop recording until... final impact.
Oh.
Maybe it stopped.
I don't know.
Picking things up. I don't know.
Whatever. Anyway, the tail. Goddamn. Yeah. So the T-tail, for those of you who don't know what it looks like, a T, basically the vertical stabilizer came off. Those two flaps came off.
Okay.
Then the tail came off and then the wings came off.
The vertical stabilizer is the tail.
Oh, and horizontal Miranda stabilizers.
Says it looks like a T. It's literally like a T sticking up from the fuselage.
Yeah.
Like at a 90 degree angle, making a T.
Yeah. Look at the website because there'll be a picture of the airplane on the website. But the tail failed first and then the wings failed. And they found that was the only way for that to have happened based on tests, that the tail had to go first and the wings would come off. They found that the separation of both tail surfaces, which are the horizontal stabilizers, could be explained only if the failures were near simultaneous. That fact led the board to conclude that the failure sequence is as follows. So this is how the whole thing happened. While flying basically in straight and level attitude, the aircraft was suddenly subjected to forces which caused it to respond violently. This was probably some sort of turbulence. I mean, they were talking about how the clouds were going like this. Mm-hmm. I'm making a circular motion in the air, by the way. So it was probably something like upward jostling or whatever. Accelerating upward and in a left roll.
Okay.
At this time, the right tailplane and the fin failed. Following this, the aircraft pitched nose down until the right wing reached its negative ultimate load, came off. The total time required for this sequence is estimated to be in the order of 1 to 2 seconds.
Oh, thank goodness.
And then the left wing came off. The loss of these components rendered the aircraft uncontrollable, and shortly afterward, it probably began a random tumbling motion, which stabilized sometime before impact into a flat spinning attitude. There was a rupture in the integral fuel tank in the wing that released a large quantity of fuel into the surrounding atmosphere, which ignited, causing the ball of fire observed by witnesses. So the plane itself didn't explode. It fell apart and the fuel ignited and that exploded.
The left wing did not fall off.
No, it did not, actually. It was just the right wing.
The right wing came off in several bits, like the tip first and then a little bit later down.
Yeah. But after you lose the tail,
you're done.
Yeah. You can't fly without a tail. Or at least the horizontal stabilizers. Yeah, you're done. Well, and if it was just the horizontal stabilizers, which is now I'm assuming what it actually says, it would make sense that the CVR kept going until impact. So.
Oh, yeah, because that would be in a different part of the tail.
Yeah, because they use the sound of the wind to figure that, but I could be...
No, you're right. I read that somewhere in the analysis that they used the sound... vibrations and stuff, etc., etc.
Was it the buffeting?
Yes. Yeah, that was basically it. I mean, they went into more detail on each individual part of everything.
Okay.
I didn't feel it necessary to go into that.
No.
The safety board had several conversations with the FAA about the safety of planes going through this amount of turbulence. And at the time, the FAA was just like, that's what planes are normally do. This is what they, it's fine. The tolerance we have now is good. That probably changed later.
Right.
And we've covered that probably in our weather series from early on. If you are new here, we have a 3-part weather series where we covered microbursts and things like that, where they definitely had to change some tolerances because planes were not doing well. So, okay, we're going to take a break. And then we'll come back and we'll do the findings and the probable cause and maybe talk a little bit more about it and all that good stuff.
Woo. Cool beans.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back.
From the brick break.
Hope you enjoyed the sponsored advertisement or non-sponsored advertisement. I don't know what you guys do nowadays.
If there's an ad, I hope you enjoyed the ad.
But I sure do enjoy the product that was featured in that ad, and you should buy it too. Give me your money, please. All right. Also, I believe there's a Patreon. You can go give us money directly.
Oh, it's back.
Patreon plug.
The plug is back.
Just give us all your money. All right, we're going into the findings here. So finding number one, the design of the BAC, which British Aerospace Systems, that's BA, I don't know. Remember what
do you want me to look it up?
I'll look it up. I got it. British Aircraft Corporation.
The British Aircraft Corporation 111-11 was in accordance with the current state of the art. And the aircraft, I feel like they didn't finish that.
I know.
State of the art. And the aircraft met all or exceeded all applicable design requirements. Finding number two, the aircraft was properly certified and airworthy at the time of the takeoff from Kansas City, Missouri. Number three, the crew was properly certified and qualified for the operation.
The operation. It sounds like a spy. Dun,
dun, dun, dun. Number four, the aircraft was confronted with a severe squall line, which was oriented across its intended flight route. The system was adequately forecast. and reported by the Weather Bureau. However, the company forecast was somewhat inaccurate with respect to the number and intensity of thunderstorms and the intensity of the associated turbulence in the system. The crew was aware of the forecasted weather and was aware that the system could have been circumnavigated to the west. This was, in fact, suggested by the first officer at some point.
Huh, interesting.
Circumnavigated to the west. So they were initially traveling around like northeast-ish.
Well, they were going northwest, right? Because to get to Omaha... Yeah,
it was like north-northwest. So it's very, very little.
So they could have gone more west.
So when they were talking about going to the left, would that have taken them more west?
I don't know if that left turn was intentional.
Okay.
I think it might have happened because of the turbulence.
Well, they originally asked for a deviation.
No, that's what I was mentioning. They asked for a deviation to the left at one point.
I think that's what they're kind of maybe starting to go towards.
Okay.
And I don't know if...
Oh, I thought that was toward the hole that they saw in the radar.
Was it?
Number five. Because the company forecast did not predict a solid line of thunderstorms, the company dispatcher did not take any action, delay, or to reroute the flight. However, the dispatcher did not relay to the crew information which might have persuaded the captain to avoid the storm system. In fact, when the dispatcher was informed of the efforts of the other aircraft to avoid the squall line, he should have recommended avoidance action to Flight 250.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. Number six. In spite of the apparent concern of the en route weather and his knowledge that the squall line was quite solid, the captain elected to penetrate the line using his airborne weather radar to select a light, quote, light area.
See, that's what I mean, is I think he saw a break, and that's why they deviated left.
Okay, yep.
Or they, like, regretted that at the last moment and decided to go left for a different reason, but that's what I thought it was.
All right, please bear with me for the next findings.
Because they're all cut off on the side of the page.
Oh, good.
Finding number seven, Flight 250, never reached the squall line. Instead, the aircraft broke up in a roll cloud approximately 5 miles from the nearest weather radar echo. Science. At this time, the aircraft was at the proper configuration and airspeed for flight in turbulence, and the autopilot was engaged. Finding number eight. It is the opinion of the board that Flight 250 encountered extreme turbulence. Extreme.
Extreme. We're talking like clear air turbulence type of turbulence. People like getting hit against the ceiling and stuff.
Very spicy air.
Very spicy.
Very spicy. And this turbulence was probably a large angled gust of very short duration with components in the... vertical.
Lateral Moreno? Vertical? It does say LA.
Yeah. Miranda might be right.
Lateral vertical?
It doesn't feel like they would fit there.
No, it doesn't.
Latitude?
Basically,
latitude?
Vertical and longitudinal planes.
Yeah.
Both
up and down and left to right.
This turbulence was generated by strong horizontal and vertical wind shears associated with the outflow of cold air from the approaching squall line. We never really talked about squall lines.
Well, the squall line is the line of thunderstorms, right?
So it's a line of thunder, basically a huge line of thunderstorms. Like, I think it comes in front of a cold front or something like that. I don't know.
Like, you see it coming before it hits you.
That makes sense.
That's what a squall line is.
And it is a, like, sudden change of weather.
It's like, if you've ever been, I mean, we live in Colorado, so this happens to us a lot. Where if you've ever been driving somewhere and then it'll just start raining and then you drive a little bit farther and it just stops. Similar to that idea.
Okay.
All right. Finding number nine. The forces and accelerations produced by this encounter caused the fin, which is the rudder, and the right tailplane, which is the right
horizontal stabilizer,
to reach their ultimate loads with near simultaneous failures resulting.
That's not a question.
The aircraft then pitched downward until the right wing reached its negative ultimate limit. The loss of these components rendered the aircraft uncontrollable, and shortly afterwards, it was probably began to random tumble, then momentarily stabilized sometime before impact into a flat spin attitude.
So it probably hit belly first, right? Yeah,
it tumbled and then it just spun.
Yeah, good stuff. Horrible. Eh.
No fun.
So probable cause, as always, verbatim from the report. The board determines that the probable cause of this accident was in-flight structural failure caused by extreme turbulence during operation of the aircraft in an area of avoidable hazardous weather. Now, there's no recommendations as far as I'm aware. Let me double check.
No, I don't believe these old reports
did that. But I mean, we can talk about why like this will never happen again now. First of all, we have ATIS.
Well, even then, the ATIS would not get this information because that's for the, what does the ATIS stand for?
Automated Terminal Information System.
Right, terminal. So it's for the...
The airport.
Airport.
But they would have, I guess that wouldn't make sense from their airport that they departed from.
So the weather in Kansas City and the weather in Omaha was fine. It was that one line of bad weather
right
in between the two that caused the whole thing.
We also just have better onboard radars now too.
Right, we have better onboard radar. Air traffic control has better radar.
Yeah.
Airlines have better radar.
Do we have a way for, like, when a pilot, you know, encounters that coming one way, for that info to get to the people going the other way? You know, do they let ATC know and ATC lets
usually people go, depending on the airline and the pilot, usually they will let ATC know, like, hey, we hit some really bad turbulence. You should let flights know that there's a thing going on.
Okay.
Yeah, there's PIREPS, pilot reports.
There we go. PIREPS. That's what I was thinking of.
I don't know when if those were a thing back in the 60s.
I don't think so, but...
But they sure are now.
Yes, they are. So pilots would make PIREPS to air traffic control, letting them know, hey, we just went through a really bad thunderstorm. Like, there's a huge thing going on. You should let other flights know they need to deviate. Kind of like, this is a bad example because this pilot did this on purpose, but there was a Delta Airlines flight, we've talked about it before, that went through a huge hailstorm, thunderstorm, several years ago. I mean, this was maybe 2016, 2017, I think.
Okay.
And they landed at DIA. I don't know if DIA was their intended airport or if they were just landing because they went through a giant thunderstorm through Kansas. But those pilots let Denver control know that, hey, there's a huge storm out here. But it turns out that they could have deviated away from that storm. They decided to go straight through instead of going around. And so instead of being hailed as heroes, the pilots got in a lot of trouble because the aircraft was damaged. I mean, damaged.
Windshields were just shattered.
Horrible. Oh, the nose cone was damaged really bad. It was bad. They had to land because the pilots couldn't see. Oh,
God.
So pilots got in real big trouble for just going straight through the thunderstorm instead of going around it because they could have. There were other planes you could see going around it. They just didn't want to. So they didn't. But yeah.
Okay.
But that would be an example, like, they knew better. Like, they definitely knew that they could have gone around because there, like I said, there were other planes that did go around. They just decided not to do that.
Well, there's other planes that diverted to a different airport.
Yes.
But as far as they were concerned, I mean, the one pilot did say that it was a solid line. But, you know, when you're talking to people, you know, how accurate is their information, right?
Okay.
You know, they're just, like, being overdramatic. I'm pretty good at that, so who knows?
My overdramatic would take your extra drama and go the other way for caution. Like, oh,
that would make
sense. A storm. Don't fly at all.
Yeah, it was Delta Flight 1889, crossed the Nebraska-Colorado border and flew right into a weather cell.
So nowadays it's...
It was 2015.
Okay.
Yeah, see, there's a picture there.
Oh my God.
Yeah, you see how damaged
it is? Oh my God. Yeah, no wonder they had to land. There's literally, you can't see anything.
And it, like, nose cone's completely gone.
Yeah, it's just dented in. Yep. There.
God.
Yeah, that was in 2015. And like I said, they found out pretty soon after that that they were like, yeah, no, not, no bueno, not good.
No bueno.
But now, like.
Nowadays, it is recommended that you don't even fly within 20 miles of any thunderstorm.
No, because there's things called, you know, microbursts.
Not just that. I mean, just even a regular thunderstorm, the updrafts and the downdrafts coming out of a regular thunderstorm. Yeah.
Were you with us when we hit that snowstorm coming back from Seattle that one time? We hit really bad turbulence coming back in.
Oh, yeah. That wasn't too bad.
Well, I mean, it was pretty rough. The plane was fine, obviously, because planes now are also meant to take more turbulence. Like, they have more, they're made out of composite and things like that that are more durable and more flexible, so that when planes do encounter turbulence, they don't just break. That too nice. Changed is like the construction of how they make planes now, and control surfaces specifically aren't made out of strict aluminum anymore because it's not as flexible. But yeah, we hit a snowstorm coming in, and it had pretty bad, I wouldn't say it was this bad of turbulence, but pretty bad turbulence. And the pilot came on and was like, sorry, we shouldn't have flown through that, but it's fine. We're okay.
I mean, coming over the Rocky Mountains, I mean, it's hard to predict.
Yeah.
So.
But thunderstorms can be really unpredictable. And I mean, lightning can cause problems too. So they're like, yeah, you should just not. That's why they cancel a lot of flights when there's thunderstorms and people get really mad because it's weather and there's nothing you can do about it. But would you rather die? I think not.
Fair enough.
Not to say you would die if you flew through a thunderstorm, but
don't risk it.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to end up like that Delta plane. That plane destroyed.
Yeah. No fun.
I mean, is there anything else? I can't think of anything else that's really changed now that this really wouldn't happen.
We don't operate flights like this anymore.
No.
Which I think probably put some pressure because, you know, flights happen late at night, but to do a series of like six flights back to back to back to back to back, it's exhausting.
Yeah. Well, and you need to get there by a certain time, right? Like,
yeah. And, you know, they probably didn't take extra time in Kansas City to look at the weather because they had to get to the next destination. They were assured by the dispatcher that it was fine. And they're like, okay, let's just go.
Let's just go. Yeah. Right. And it was fine, but it wasn't fine. So,
because there was a the weather service posted a thing for the severe weather, which if they would have saw that, who knows, they may have changed their minds.
Yeah,
they would have seen that prior to the departure of the plane.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's so much more communication too now. Like, right. The dispatcher's not the one in charge of grounding a plane. I mean, they're one of the people that can, but
it is a joint thing between the dispatcher and the captain.
Yeah. So, I mean, the captain can be like, I don't like the look of the weather. We're not going. And the dispatcher, okay. And the dispatcher can also go, hey, weather's really bad, which was the case here. The captain probably could have said,
no, he had the authority to say, no, we're not going to go.
Yeah. He decided to go anyway because the dispatcher said it was okay. But, I mean, we already talked about that. Probably didn't have enough time to relook at the weather to make sure it was okay. Despite having, my confusion was, is he talked to another captain about how bad it was, and then he still decided to go anyway.
We were just talking about that while you were looking up the...
Oh.
We were talking about how...
I wasn't listening.
That happened with the last episode I was here for, the bonus episode. They were all like, bad snow, this is terrible. And they paid no attention.
Yeah, they were like, oh, that's fine.
It's fine. Word of mouth things, it's hard to actually get the full picture because you don't know if they're exaggerating a little bit.
That's true.
Or if they're just...
And I forget these pilots are often under like a ton of pressure to go ahead and do the flight instead of, you know, erring.
I mean, especially
on the side
in
of
the
caution.
60s.
Right, yeah. The safety was like six on the priority list.
Yeah, not one, which most of it is now is number one. Safety's first. All right. I think that's it, right?
I think so.
Braniff Airlines Flight 250. Thanks so much for being here, Brendan and Paige.
Thank you for having me back.
Covering for us while Christy and Nick are gone. We do appreciate you guys popping in. That being said, I'm going to say again, please be nice.
We did our best with this episode.
Paige will do. You
can rip me to shreds. That's fine.
Paige will do their best to do the editing magic so it doesn't sound so strange. It'll have a lot of good stuff in the blooper reel. So you should be a patron so you can listen to that.
Patron plug.
If you thought you were only getting one Patreon plug, no, you get two because Brendan's here with me this time.
Then we're going to set up Patreon Premium for those of you that are really serious about it. Okay, get on that.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad that it's my job.
Then after we get that established, we can do Patreon Premium Plus.
Oh, jeez.
Patreon Platinum?
Patreon Platinum Plus.
Oh, I don't even know what that involves. How many more tiers is that going to be? What are we going
to
do?
We can just keep... I will fly to you. With the $10,000 you put in monthly.
Yeah.
For the
Brendan
platinum.
Will use that for flight stuff. specifically.
If you want to pay for a vacation for me, by all means, send it my way. I will gladly accept bribes and
bribes. Good God.
Yeah. So.
All right. Thank you so much for listening. We do appreciate it. We would like you to have a safe and healthy week, and we'll catch you all next week.
Keep your speed up.
Please like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Hard Landings Podcast and on Twitter at Hard Landings Pod.
Subscribe and leave a 5-star review on the platform you are using to listen.
If you would like to see photos and sources for this episode, please visit us at hardlandingspodcast.com, where you can also leave us feedback and ask questions.
This episode was researched and written by Nick and Christy and edited by the lovely Paige.
Our theme song was written by Miranda and performed by all three of us plus Leo.
And our logo is by Naomi.
Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.